Welcome to the Mormon News Report podcast for the week of September 25th, 2017. We are your weekly dose of Mormonism.
With your weekly dose of snark to help you get through the week in Mormon news.
So we've got a great show lined up for you today. Tom Christofferson will be joining us to talk about his new book, That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family from, wait, Brant, do I have this right? Published by Deseret Book?
You know it, Brian. You know, I have a feeling we'll talk more about that in our interview with Tom. But guys, do you want to hear some of the scoops? You should become a supporter on Patreon, where the Mormon News Report extended sessions are available to subscribers for just $1 a month. Your $1 or more gets you access to all the juicy little tidbits that only our Patreons get to hear.
Think of it kind of like the multiple degrees of the celestial kingdom. It's our little thank you to our supporters for helping us provide you with the best coverage, commentary, analysis, and a sprinkling of snark to breaking Mormon news.
Guys, it's simple. Just head over to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a Patreon subscriber today.
And besides that, there's other ways that you can still support us. A review on iTunes. We really appreciate it. It goes a long way in helping our search rankings come up. Also, a share on Facebook, a retweet on Twitter. Those all help us out. Brant, I've been busy researching and prepping. Are there any questions in the Q&A stack?
Let me wipe the dust off. No, the sack.
That's a shame. I was really looking forward to taking it on this week.
Guys, Brian is ready, willing, and able to tackle your questions. So let me toss one out there for you. As I've grown older, Brian, I've learned to love teaching lessons involving sexuality. So like chastity, sexual purity to the youth, mostly because I like watching them squirm and get uncomfortable. As a matter of fact, let me tell you this quick story. Probably about 5 years ago, we had the BYU lacrosse team come out here to Michigan. They were going to do some, you know, intramural scrimmage or whatever, right? I was an elders quorum teacher at the time, and I didn't realize we had this huge class here. So I prepared two lessons for some reason or another. I don't remember exactly why. And so I gave everybody the option. I said, okay, so guys, which lesson we want to do? We could talk about like Joseph Smith, or we could talk about what I originally prepared, which was the law of chastity. And Brian, I'm not kidding you. Every single one of those BYU lacrosse players that were married immediately looked at all the ones who were not married yet or all the ones who hadn't gone on missions, and they were like, yeah, we're doing the chastity lesson. So it's one of the personal favorite things that I've loved. What is your weird guilty pleasure in Mormonism?
Okay, so first of all, Brant, your guilty pleasure makes me kind of uncomfortable and squirm, just to be honest with you. But as far as my guilty pleasure, oh man. So, okay, I do have a story, but this just shows you kind of like how on the fringes I am. So if any of our listeners have wondered, like, where does Brian sit on the spectrum, you're going to just know that Brian is a complete heathen at this point. Okay. So when I was in the Boy Scouts, you know, church Boy Scouts, obviously, at one camp out, I thought it would be really hilarious to spike the beans with bourbon. Right? So I actually like found a bottle of bourbon. I mean, it wasn't that hard to find. Got a bottle of bourbon and just like put some of it in a little, like a little Tupperware cup. So nobody would know what it was. And then when nobody was looking, I poured it into our beans that were cooking on the pot and expected everybody to just be goofy drunk from what I had done. I mean, I was probably like 12 at the time. I didn't know that alcohol actually cooks out, right? So the only person acting drunk was me. So anyway, that was my guilty pleasure, was always bringing in something that was a little bit taboo into, whether it be a scouts or whether it be, you know, going to church dance and bringing like caffeinated soda, which by the way is not as taboo now. And I guess we're going to get to that topic a little bit later, but in the meantime, Brant, on with the news.
That's right. Brian, it feels like this is a common occurrence nowadays. Another natural disaster has hit and the Mormons are making statements.
Yeah, that's right, Brant. This time, the location in question was Mexico City, as a 7.1 magnitude earthquake rocked the city.
The LDS Church issued the following statement. We have confirmed that all missionaries in the region affected by Tuesday's earthquake in Mexico have been contacted and are safe. Mission presidents have been in contact with families to let them know they are well. Side note, interesting little tidbit based on what we've learned on previous natural disasters. Missionary apartments in several missions sustained damage, including a few that are now uninhabitable. Missionaries are eager to participate in the cleanup efforts and will do so as they are able to safely engage. Several Latter-day Saint chapels were also impacted, and teams are assessing the extent of the damage. We continue to pray for the people of Mexico as they recover from this serious earthquake.
No words as to the cleanup efforts by the Mormons in the area, but you know they're going to be there.
They always are. Brian, you know what? Let's just go ahead and get the sad stories out of the way first. Let's go into Elizabeth Smart next. In an interview with Chris Hansen, she said that the first time she was raped after being abducted by Brian David Mitchell, she believed she had been robbed of her virtue or virginity and was therefore worthless.
So Smart said, for me, because I grew up in a very conservative Christian neighborhood, the first time I was raped, I remember feeling devastated. I felt like it would be better to be dead than to continue living being a rape victim, being a rape survivor. I felt in that moment, if there had been an easy way out, I probably would have taken it.
She continues, she didn't try to escape because she felt like a chewed up piece of gum. Nobody rechews a piece of gum, you throw it away. Repeating an analogy she had heard while she was growing up.
And you know, we've all felt for a long time that the rhetoric used around assault needed to change. Elizabeth's crusade in speaking about her ordeal and using her quote unquote fame as an opportunity to talk about these hard issues and, you know, specifically the culture within Mormonism regarding sexual issues, specifically sexual assault. I mean, like, this is so needed.
It's interesting. It's almost as if her positioning within the Mormon culture has empowered her to not just make statements like these, but to also be a driving force for change. So in Peggy Fletcher Stack's column in the Tribune, she even notes that a scripture under the heading of virtue in the Young Woman's Study Manual described how evil men kidnapped the daughters of the Lamanites and then deprived them of, quote, that which was most dear and precious above all other things, which is chastity and virtue, end quote, was removed from the manual last year. So guys, it's happening, and girls, it is happening. Frankly, it sucks that something like what happened to Elizabeth had to happen for it to change. But you know what, Brian? God bless her for speaking up about these undoubtedly traumatic events that occurred in her life and using it for good.
The tides, they are turning for Mormons, Brian.
Well, caffeine is allowed on BYU campus, Brian.
Spoiler alert. Besides, we're going to still get to that one in a bit. So a citizen initiative in Utah is attempting to put medical marijuana on the November 2018 ballot. The LDS Church came out against the initiative earlier this year, but it seems like fellow Mormons might feel differently. A new poll from UtahPolicy.com shows that 74% of Utahns favor the legalization of medical marijuana. Even more interesting, 63% supporting the legislation of medical marijuana for a specific disease and or pain relief, self-classified as, quote, very active Mormons.
That's two-thirds. That obviously means that one-third or 33% of very active Mormons stand with the LDS Church in opposition to legislation in Utah. But as Utah Policy Bob Burnick notes, this is, quote, basically unheard of in Utah.
Do you think we should pontificate on this one, Brant?
Can we do that on a Mormon show?
Has it ever stopped us in the past?
Bring it.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot. Yes or no, does the Medical Marijuana Initiative make it on the ballot for November of 2018?
I'll say yes, it does. So mark it down. Here's what I think. I think Utah Republicans are warming up to the idea of it. As a matter of fact, this last poll that we saw from UtahPolicy.com showed that 61% were in favor of it versus 35% of it who were not in favor of it. That's just Utah Republicans. And even those who describe themselves as very conservative are in favor of it by a small margin. So 51% in favor, 42% not in favor if they qualify themselves as very conservative.
Okay. So that was just part one. Part two, does this legislation get passed?
Okay. So that's the hard one. So yes, I do think it's going to make it on the ballot. I don't think it's going to be passed. I think this is going to be like the general election in Utah all over again. So yeah, it gets on the ballot. I could also see the LDS Church doing a big campaign against it, including some of the language that they used previously, calling for more testing and more research. And I could see a few major outlets in Utah, and I think y'all know who I'm talking about, running some op-eds and opinion pieces against it. And at the end of the day, I think when the voter goes behind the curtain in the booth, I really do think they do act differently than they do when it's someone calling them trying to get polling information. It's the Donald Trump effect of Utah. For a long time, it seemed that he was losing all this ground and it looked like there might be a tight race. But then on election day, Utahns voted how people thought it was going to vote. They voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Okay, so that's my hot take. Brian, same question to you. Does it make it to ballot and does it get passed?
So, I mean, before I go and answer your question, I have to say I'm really uncomfortable with the idea of the Donald Trump effect on Utah. So please do not make that a thing. Does it make it to the ballot? Yes, I think it's going to make it to the ballot. There is enough support behind it to just based on how the political process works, that it will hit the ballot. Does it get passed? I'm with you, Brant. I think that Utahns talk a big talk. You're going to see a lot of support coming out for it. And then you're also going to see stuff against it. Like you said, it'll be mostly polite, mostly civil, mostly we just, you know, this is untested. We're not ready for releasing this to the public. Does it pass? Probably not. Does it reemerge down the line and get more sophisticated campaigning behind it? Yes, I think so. So I don't think it's going to pass this time, but I don't think this is going to be the last time that we see this initiative.
So it's not going to pass. How much of a margin is it going to get defeated by? Is it going to be a close victory? Is it going to be a big victory?
I think it's going to be a fairly close
I do too.
Victory. Yeah. I mean, I'm guessing like 53, 54, maybe 56%.
Yeah. And I'm with you. I think it's going to be close, and I think we're going to see it again. So Utahns and Mormons, get ready for it. Let's move on to a non-marijuana related story, and I mean that with all sincerity. The University of Utah named its first Mormon studies professor, and the name should be very familiar to many of you.
Yeah, for those of you who follow Mormon studies and followed our past podcast, This Month in Mormon Studies, author of Religion of a Different Color, Race and the Mormon Struggle for Whiteness, W. Paul Reeve, was named to this post. So Reeve has taught and written extensively about Mormonism, and his excellent book on Mormons being perceived as a different race in the late 19th century won the Mormon History Association's Best Book Award, as well as the John Whitmer Historical Association's Smith Pettit Best Book Award, and the Utah State Historical Society's Francis Armstrong Madsen Best History Book Award. Oh my gosh, I'm running out of air.
Well, you can take a breath, Brian. It is okay. And I will say this, you guys see all those awards. Yeah, you really should be reading this book. It's really good. And this is another awesome step for the University of Utah in their blossoming Mormon studies focus. So not only will Paul help in pushing the U towards their goal of being a leader in the field of Mormon studies, but he's also going to be leading a new history project called A Century of Black Mormons. This effort is going to build a database of Black converts baptized into the Mormon faith between 1830 and 1930. The Digital History Project seeks to recover the names and lives of Black Mormons who have been erased from collective Mormon memory. Their lives matter, and the names deserve to be known, Paul Reeve said to the Deseret News.
So Paul's a really great historian and professor. And I, you know, just on a personal level, he's a very good guy to work with. And I am nothing but optimistic about this. And he's going to be a great leader for the Use Mormon Studies initiatives.
Absolutely. Moving on, Brian, do you remember hearing about that app called Mutual a while back?
That sounds familiar. Wasn't that the Mormon version of Tinder?
Ah, good memory for an old man, Brian. Well, CNN has a profile piece today about the Mormons who use the app, including an interview with Benjamin Brown, a 31-year-old single man who was seemingly desperate to find his mate.
Quote, I literally flew all over the country to date. I was booking red eyes just to attend church somewhere and meet new people. Some weekends, I would go to 3, 4, or if I was really ambitious, 5 wards in one Sunday. This is all what Brown said, obviously. Single wards often feel like meat markets. So much of church revolves around dating. Hope he had some serious flyer miles there.
Whoa.
And the founder of Mutual, Cooper Boyce, says that he's found a meat market. More than 100,000 Mormons in more than 100 countries around the world have swiped through the app more than 250 million times.
So we're going to link to this piece in the show notes, but it's really a very good piece about the experience of young single adults in the LDS church. For example, I didn't know that there were that many people using that app. I mean, there's obviously a market for it, right?
As a matter of fact, it kind of seems like a double-edged sword, doesn't it? On the one hand, there's about 150 Mormon women for every 100 Mormon men, and that's according to an American Religious Identification Survey. You know, and so it creates this bit of a statistical dilemma. And this isn't new. Even going back 5 years, there's a great documentary titled Duck Beach that looked at the experience of young single Mormons.
But you know, at the same time, you've got apps out there like Tinder and like Mutual and like others that allow you to connect with people outside of your general geographic area. So sure, you're always going to have that one friend of your mom's who's trying to hook you up with this really cute girl or guy who would be absolutely perfect for you. But you can also expand your search to outside of the area. I'll admit, though, I'm just glad this wasn't around when I was in college, because I usually said something that ticked people off on the first date. So I'm glad I'm married at this point with all that stuff.
Your wife is sure a lucky woman.
Of course. Okay, Brian, player's choice. We have a choice for the last two stories that we can cover this week. We can either start with the Book of Mormon manuscript or the big news about caffeine on BYU campus.
Okay, so let's get our BYU takes out of the way. I think that we're going to need some time for the manuscript.
You got it. BYU it is. So major news this week, everybody. BYU Dining Services announced on Thursday that it will now begin selling caffeinated beverages on campuses. And pick your jaws up off the floor, guys. This is big news.
Carrie Jenkins, University Communications spokeswoman, said, "We have seen consumer preferences change over time. This decision is a measure to accommodate consumer requests."
No joke, guys. There's even an FAQ on the decision on the BYU Dining Services page. The first question had a very interesting response. Question, when did the dining services make the decision not to sell caffeinated soft drinks? Answer, in the mid-1950s, the director of BYU Food Services decided not to sell caffeinated soft drinks. The decision has been continued on since that time. Until more recently, dining services rarely receive requests for caffeinated soda. Consumer preferences have clearly changed and requests have become much more frequent. End quote. Brian, who was the president of BYU during the 1950s?
You tell me, Brent.
I believe that was Ernest Wilkinson, wasn't it?
You got me.
It was Ernest Wilkinson, which would come as no surprise to anybody who knows the way that Ernest Wilkinson approached certain things on BYU's campus. Let's put it that way.
And let's not forget this, Jem. There are those who would say that dining services should not be offering soda at all. How would you respond to these concerns? Answer, we realize that there are many choices to be made, and some are more nutritious than others. We strive to offer a variety of food choices and encourage our customers to make healthy choices. We encourage our patrons to visit the dining services website, where a program is available to promote not only healthy eating, but also healthy lifestyle. The program is referred to on the website as EAT. Eat, Act, Think.
Gosh, that is one of the most Mormon sounding things I've heard in a while. So Brian, I've been covering Mormon news for a long time, and it always amazes me at what the mainstream media is going to grab onto when it comes to Mormon news stories. We've got a legitimate story from the Washington Post about the change.
So from Matt Bowman writing for the Washington Post, Bowman writes for a non-Mormon audience who is probably wondering, so why the heck is this a big deal? Bowman covers a lot of ground here, the BYU Honor Code, the history of the Word of Wisdom and caffeine, and the history of BYU. He writes, whether one celebrates or laments BYU's choice to sell caffeinated beverages, then might come down to whether one views the lowering of those boundaries as a good thing or not. The escalation of moral expectation that left rape victims afraid to come forward was driven by a destructive scrupulosity that wrecked students' lives. But it is not as though anybody agrees that, indeed, selling more sugary soda is a good thing of itself. Mormons' avoidance of caffeine is among a number of quirks that paints an image on them as irredeemably square, out of step, plastic, and tone deaf, the sort of media coverage Mitt Romney was often subjected to. But of course, it was the same earnest personality that led Romney to become the first major Republican to condemn presidential candidate Donald Trump as an immoral phony.
Matt Bowman continues, BYU's choice to sell caffeinated soda then may well be driven by our market-oriented society, and we might celebrate it as a victory for individual choice and personal expression. But BYU's long resistance to doing so should inspire us to think hard about whether the values of the market are all as equally worthwhile.
Of course, it wouldn't be a big deal if the internet didn't explode. For example, BYU student at Aaron Mendoza 92 wrote, they ran out of lids for the fountain drinks. I can't breathe.
At Trevor Gibby 1 wrote, tell us something interesting about yourself. I was a student at BYU when they legalized caffeine.
And let's not forget at Jen Linz, and in that day there shall be caffeine and rumors of beards. But see that he not be troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But Brant, I've got a much bigger question. Is your alma mater going to join the trend, or is BYU-Idaho going to go all, you know, BYU-Idaho on us again?
Funny you should ask, Brian. The Idaho Statesman talked with BYU-Idaho spokesman Brent Crandall, who said BYU-Idaho has not received an influx of requests for caffeinated drinks and has no plans to follow its sister campus. Quote, we weren't seeking to change anything, said Crandall. We haven't been receiving any requests.
Idahoans, you know what you need to do.
Guys, do it for me. Do it for those of us who came before you without access to caffeine on campus. Do it for our legacy.
Oh, Idaho.
Okay, Brian, bring us home. I'm going to be honest. I'm going to lean on your background as a historian and your experience working with the community of Christ on this one to help me with some context.
Let's get the details out of the way first. The LDS Church this past week purchased the original printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon, which was previously owned by the Community of Christ, or the RLDS Church, as they were previously known, for $35 million, which incidentally is the highest price paid for a manuscript. The manuscript is going to be on display at the Church History Library in Salt Lake City.
So I got to ask a question, Brian. Is this why BYU is now selling caffeinated drinks to pay for the manuscript?
Oh my gosh. Oh, I can't, but that's probably like the 147th time that I've heard that joke this week, Brian. But seriously, this is a big deal. The manuscript was owned by the Community of Christ, again, the former RLDS Church, since 1903. So Elder Stephen E. Snow, who's the historian and recorder for the LDS Church, said in a statement on the church's website, quote, we hold the Book of Mormon to be a sacred text like the Bible. The printer's manuscript is the earliest surviving copy of about 72% of the Book of Mormon text, as only about 28% of the earlier dictation copy survived decades of storage in a cornerstone in Nauvoo, Illinois.
You mentioned the price tag earlier, right? The price tag is a big deal, right? Like, to me, $35 million is really expensive. But if you're talking about a manuscript like this, is it really expensive or not really? Or like, put the price tag in context for me.
Well, I mean, so that's the thing about this manuscript. It set a new standard. The previous record for the purchase of a document was Leonardo da Vinci's Codex Leicester in 1994 by Bill Gates for $30.8
million. Wow. So this obviously surpassed that. It set a record. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, actually, the Salt Lake Tribune talked with Mormon historian John Hiasek, who thinks that the manuscript could have gone for $100 million. I'm not sure if I would have gone to that extent, but you know, this is a pretty pivotal part of Mormon history.
All right, so I've got to address the elephant in the room here. $35 million is a lot of money, and I've seen some parts on the internet. Are they right in saying it should have gone to charity?
Let's go through a few things. Of course, that crowd is rearing its stupid head once again. First, this was all private donation. Second, there's more going on behind the scenes here. If you were to ask me, it's less about the manuscript and more about what's going on in the community of Christ. The money's going to go to help out a financially strapped church to pay their retirement employee pensions. In other words, this money is literally going to the elderly. So just calm down. And I don't think that this decision was made lightly. Community of Christ historian David Howlett said, quote, "I love my denomination and its heritage. I'm saddened that the sale of the printer's manuscript of the Book of Mormon was necessary to fund our retiree pensions fund. However, church leaders made an obvious moral choice to choose people over an artifact. Joseph Smith III, who was the first prophet president of the RLDS Church, purchased the manuscript for $2,500 in 1903. As pragmatic as Joseph III was, I cannot imagine that if he was the church president today, he would have chosen to default on obligations to the elderly if it could have been avoided by the sale of an artifact. And if our present church had left the obligations unfunded, it would have completely misunderstood the ethical messages of the Book of Mormon. So yes, I am really sad about this turn of events, but still very proud of my little church." So yeah, I know John called it the, you know, biggest game changer in Mormon history, but he's completely forgetting that the Joseph Smith papers already published the transcription of this manuscript. It's not a game changer to historians. We already have all of the content of this. It's been analyzed and reanalyzed. Royal Skousen did it. The Joseph Smith papers did it. You know, I mean, honestly, Brant, at most, this is just going to make for a really cool display at the Church History Museum.
So it sounds like the bigger story here is not the manuscript itself, and not even really the price that the church paid for it, but more the charitable act of the LDS Church towards the community of Christ.
You know, consider where the churches were even like 60 years ago, and look at what they're jointly doing together now. And knowing the backstory behind why they sold the manuscript, I mean, yeah, I got to be honest, Brant, it kind of irks me when people are too interested in taking their pitchforks to the fire rather than wanting to look a little bit deeper at the issue. When the only tool that you have is a hammer, then you treat everything as if it were a nail. Could we have just given them the $35 million and say, here, let's help out your retiree pensions? Sure, I suppose that we could have. So there was an exchange that takes place here, but there's also a little bit of pride that takes place here as well. I mean, the community of Christ isn't going to want to have just a handout from its cousin organization over in Utah, right? So for them, this is also a decision that they had to arrive at, that it was time to relinquish these papers and also trust that the purchaser of these, you know, incredibly important documents are the right ones and are the ones who are going to treat them respectfully, who are going to maintain them, who are going to make sure that they're properly cared for. And who better than the LDS Church, who number one has the money and number two has the means to be able to make sure that this document is preserved for generations upon generations. And number three has a vested interest in having a document like this to be able to present to its own people.
But Brian, that's the crazy thing. And I keep going back to this. You had mentioned if you look at what happened 60 years ago, I can't imagine if 60 years ago this happened, that we would have been this respectful in the exchange of things. I mean, you look at the way that the LDS Church worded their press release and statement. They didn't talk anything about the money. They just talked about we now have this manuscript. It's a pivotal part of our church and our upbringing. Where 60 years ago, that relationship wasn't there. And so I view this as such a strong and kind gesture. And frankly, something that I can't imagine was easy for the community of Christ to come to. I mean, granted, I know that the churches, they view the Book of Mormon differently. But at the same time, there is still a lot of reverence within the community of Christ for the Book of Mormon. And to sit there and say, this is one of the pivotal documents of our church, and we are going to be relinquishing this because we have to pay these retiree pension funds. I can't imagine that came easy. And the fact that they were willing to do that, that's an important thing, right? And we'll be back with Tom Christofferson.
If you're looking for more current news coverage on Mormonism, why don't you try the Mormon News Report? The Mormon News Report is a weekday email sent hot and fresh to your inbox every day by 9 a.m. covering the top stories in Mormonism with just a tiny bit of snark. Our focus is on actual news from actual newspaper and reporters covering all aspects of Mormonism. If you're interested in signing up, email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com with your name and zip code. We use that for demographic purposes. You could like the Mormon News Report on Facebook. You could find us on Twitter at The Mormon News, or visit theculturalhall.com/Mormon-news-report for more information. When the darkness creeps.
we'd like to welcome onto the show Tom Christofferson. Tom is the author of the book That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family, published by Deseret Book. In addition, Tom is one of the founding board members of Encircle, a group providing resources to support LGBTQ individuals and their families in Provo, Utah. Tom, welcome onto the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, Tom, as much as I don't want to start our interview with you talking about somebody else, I do want to kick this off and with how you introduced yourself at the recent Love Loud Music Festival. You said, quote, "I'm not the famous brother, I'm the gay brother." So can you just give our listeners a little bit of background into your family? They may be familiar with another Christofferson.
Sure. I am the youngest of five sons in my family. And the oldest is Elder D. Todd Christofferson. So they probably know that name.
I loved your introduction, though. I think it got a pretty good laugh out of the people that were there at the music festival.
Well, I have to tell you, a friend of mine was at a lunch with Elder Christofferson a few months ago, and having heard me say, no, I'm the gay brother, several times, and the Deseret News seems to think that's my first name, Apostle's Gay Brother Christofferson. She went up to him when she was introduced and said, "Oh, you're Tom's straight brother."
Oh, that's good.
That's really good. He looked at her like she had three heads. He didn't.
So I've got to ask you, because I'm always intrigued with how this dynamic works. So you've referred to your brother a couple of times as Elder Christofferson. How does that work? How do you differentiate between just calling him, I'm not sure what you would call him, Todd, or Elder Christofferson? How do you differentiate between the two of those?
Well, to me, he's Todd, but if we're in public, then it's usually Elder Christofferson.
Interesting. I just always find it interesting because it's something that a lot of people just don't have any context for. So let's get into the book. I want to thank you for writing this book. I think it's extremely important at this point in our society that we give voice to all of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters, and that we, quite frankly, address the elephant in the room about what it means to be gay or to be bisexual or to be transgendered and an active believing Mormon. So I guess my first question is this. How did this book come about? This is a pretty progressive move for Deseret Book.
I thought so too. I kept waiting for them to say, well, that's interesting, but I don't think we'd be comfortable publishing that. And surprisingly, they didn't. my hope had been that through the experiences of my family and my ward in New Canaan, Connecticut, when I started going back to church, where neither family nor ward family erected barriers. In other words, that it was always just a warm welcome and a desire to be supportive and engaged. I felt like that story can help us, or be one of the stories that help us start a more productive conversation. I feel like we've heard the shouts from either end, but there's a productive conversation to be had in the middle, with where we combine the ideas of faith and the reality of a gay life.
So this was a manuscript that you had pitched as a proposal to Deseret Book?
I was having lunch with a mutual friend and Sherry Dew one day, and we were talking about, she knew some of the story and said, yeah, I think there could be value in this being known more broadly, and talked about some of the broadcast capabilities of Deseret Management Corp. And I said, gosh, I've always wanted to write a book. And I think she thought that was low tech in comparison to what she was thinking about. So 2 weeks later, we had lunch, and I gave her an outline of the book, and she was an incredible proponent of really trying to see if there was something there that could be useful to a broader audience.
Well, I think books still matter a great deal, particularly because of their permanence.
The thing I loved about doing the book was that I could carefully convey the message that I was trying to deliver.
So tell me just a little bit, what was the editorial process like working with Deseret Book? Because, you know, like we mentioned, that's kind of a progressive move for them. Did you find it was a good relationship between the two of you as you were going about and the, not just the work that you did, but then their editorial process of putting in what, I need to be careful about how I phrase this, but basically making sure it fit to what their brand and what they wanted.
Right. I mean, the first gift in that process was Emily Watts, who is the editor of the book, and who, as you're getting a feel for, I don't speak in short sentences. And so she was challenged with how to insert paragraphs and periods on a more frequent basis than I had. But, you know, honestly, as we went through the process, I was sending them chapters as I wrote them. So they had a chance to see kind of how I was trying to express the feelings that I had and my thoughts. And then it came time after a first draft review for their advisory committee to review it. And I, you know, I was kind of crossing my fingers and holding my breath to see if that was going to be something that that group could feel comfortable with. And the feedback was very positive. There were a few suggestions of things that they thought I could add that could be useful. And so it was really, it was surprising to me that it went kind of as smoothly as it did.
And I think that, you know, with Sherry Dew, I think that sometimes we get this this impression because of the capacities that she's served in church leadership in the past. We get this certain impression that maybe she wouldn't be quite as open to exploring things that are, oh, you know, maybe somewhat sensitive in nature. But that doesn't seem to be the case with her, does it? She seems to be pretty willing to go down these paths.
I'm a fan. I have to say I've gotten to know her through really through this process. But I've been stunned at, consider as you kind of mentioned, her experience, the roles that she's had and all the things that she's done. And yet she's someone who, President Hinckley, is just so eager to ask questions and eager to understand anyone else's experience and their way of understanding the world, what perceptions and experiences anyone else has. And so I loved our conversation. She really was just so open to anything that I wanted to observe, and also very willing to chat about things when I really wanted to understand her perspective.
So you make it clear in the first few pages that your experiences aren't meant to be a prescription for anybody else. You know, we occasionally come across articles by, LDS Living that tell stories of individuals. And I'm thinking of people like Josh Weed, who is a gay man who's in a successful heterosexual marriage. Or more recently, they published an interview as a video interview with a couple of gals named Courtney and Rochelle, who are a lesbian couple who are married, but who chose to divorce in order to return to full church activity. And I mean, these are powerful and very personal stories, and I don't want to give the impression of any skepticism towards them at all, because that's not how I feel. But, you know, is there a certain concern with stories like this and with the aim of your book that these sorts of things can be used, well, I don't know, uncharitably by parents of gay or lesbian kids?
Yeah, I certainly worry about it. I mean, my desire is that this is, as I said in the book, an appreciation for the life I've been allotted. And my desire of sharing it is really the idea that there may be ideas within the book. There may be something in the way that my parents reacted and the way they conducted our family's engagement over the decades, something in the way a bishop approached a conversation or a ward embraced someone who was not actually a member, but a very active non-member, that could be useful to people as they are striving to figure out the right answer for their family or for their ward. So it's not meant to be, you know, this is a to-do list, you know, do these four steps and life will be great. It's really just, look, here's the experience that I've had. And if there's something there that you would find a stimulation of other ideas of in your personal experience and need, then that would be really wonderful.
And Tom, if I could, I think the benefit of people like Josh, people like Courtney and Rochelle, and even your story is the fact that it is, because we're seeing a wide variety of different experiences that are coming out, I would hope that people would realize that just as people can have a different experience with, for example, how they experience Mormonism, people can have all these different types of experiences. So we can't do a cookie cutter approach and say, here's how it needs to go. I think by having all these stories out there, including yours, it opens the field to say we need to be more cognizant of just the overall experience that people are going through.
I agree. I've been reading Hillary Clinton's new book about the last election, and I'm going to forget who it is she quoted, but the gist of her comment was that whenever there is anyone gains freedom in America, it frees us all, or we all gain a greater degree of freedom as a result. And I feel that way, you know, in our experience as brothers and sisters in the gospel of Jesus Christ, when any of us can embrace and expand our hearts, when we can have a new heart that allows us to understand compassionately something we've not before, then there's greater freedom for all of us and a greater opportunity to to participate in the gospel.
And, you know, I think by having a lot of these stories out there, one of the things that is that does come up time and time again is that the reality of being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgendered in the LDS church, it does require a degree of sacrifice. And at this point, if you want to be in full fellowship, your choices are either to marry heterosexually or to choose celibacy. Those aren't easy choices. I couldn't imagine being faced with something like that. If you don't mind, there was something in your book that quite honestly, it almost put me to tears. You wrote, sometimes the comparison has been made between LGBTQ and other single brothers and sisters who desire marriage, but for various reasons have not had that blessing. The law of chastity and its requirements are the same for each, people point out. May I suggest that there is at least one significant difference? Whereas a single straight sister can pray each morning that today will be the day she will meet the man that she will marry in the house of the Lord, a gay brother striving to be celibate will pray each morning that his heart will be closed, that he will not meet a man whom he has desire to love and marry. To desire companionship, to me, is just so natural and human. To sacrifice that for the sake of piety is both noble and heart-wrenching. To be honest, if one of my sons or daughters turned out to be gay or lesbian, I'm not sure I'd want to have them sacrifice companionship in order to remain in full fellowship with the church. What do you say to those who say, Tom, I can't do it. I love the church, but I can't survive without the kind of love and companionship that everybody else gets to enjoy? Because that's a hard thing to be able to acknowledge and confront for so many people.
Yeah, I think that elemental desire to love and be loved by the unique other is part of our makeup, part of who we are. And I don't think that ever goes away. As you point out, there are two paths if you want to remain in full fellowship. So there are three choices for any LGB person: to marry someone of the same sex, marry someone of the opposite sex, or to be celibate. And there is a cost, a price to be paid for any one of those choices you make. And there are blessings that arrive from any of those choices that are made. And the point I'm trying to make in the book over and over is I really do believe people are doing the best they can. And that my counsel, to the extent that I'm in a position to offer any, is do everything you can to be close to the Spirit and make the best decisions you can at every stage in your life and walk with faith. And, you know, that we have great trust that in the Lord's own time, you know, he will reveal what he will reveal, and to each of us individually, as well as to the church as a whole. And that our greatest opportunity as disciples of Jesus Christ is to live the first two commandments and in the belief that everything else will be added unto or comes out of those two commandments.
Now, I'd like to switch gears a little and talk about your own experiences with returning to activity, which is a large theme in your book, and it's all detailed in your book, I should point out. But set the stage for us. So earlier on in the book, you discuss your family life growing up, and then you discuss that you were in a heterosexual marriage for a short time. You were married in a temple, but then had it quickly annulled. So let's talk about from that point forward, kind of some bullet points of what happened.
You know, I kind of came to the conclusion that I felt I'd done everything I could do. I'd worked as hard as I could to be a good Mormon boy. And, you know, this is in the mid 80s. And I felt like I'd come to the end of that path. I couldn't figure out how to be gay and Mormon. So I needed to figure out if I could be gay and happy. And I asked to be excommunicated so that I could, I don't know, to me, it felt important to not only not be actively Mormon, but, you know, not to be Mormon as I tried to explore that. I hope that's not a feeling that other people now think is their only choice, but to me, it felt like it at the time. And so I had a very happy life. I sort of described myself as I was a happy gay non-Mormon, and now I'm a happy gay Mormon again. But I met a wonderful man when I was living in San Francisco, working there about 22, 23 years ago now. And we built a life together and were embraced by both of our families and welcomed by our families and had a, you know, enjoyable careers and all the fun stuff, you know, to be able to enjoy in life. But at a certain point, I just kind of felt like something was missing, you know, that an element of spirituality and a sense of higher purpose. And those were things that I already knew the answer to. When I left the church, it wasn't because I didn't believe. It was because I couldn't see a place for myself there. And so my thought initially, and this, you know, was kind of built over a period of time. We had attended a number of other churches, but I just felt like this was the right place for me. And I started to attend a sacrament meeting in the New Canaan ward in Connecticut, but without talking to anybody, without telling anybody I was there. So I would just sort of sneak in after the meeting had started. And as soon as the closing prayer was uttered, I'd zip out without saying anything, and did that for actually several months, and then finally asked to speak to the bishop. And that was the beginning of that path of return. My original idea going back to church was, because of commitments that I had made to my partner, I wasn't free to make additional commitments. And then over the few years of attending and kind of getting a greater and greater desire to be able to do more within the church, my hope had been that at least the emotional connection that we had, you know, our lives together could continue, even though I might become a member of the church. And that was the path that we followed for a period of time and for a few months after my baptism. But, you know, my partner had done the amazing thing of saying, look, I want you to do what's going to be the right thing for you, in spite of the cost that might have in his life. And a few months after my baptism, when he said he really felt like this was not a way of happiness for him, then it was my turn to do the same thing of wanting to support him in doing what he felt would be the best thing for him. So that, you know, that's not been an easy path.
Yeah. Yeah. But there was the moment in your story when, like I said, when your temple blessings were restored to you at the hands of your brother.
Yeah. It was a wonderful experience. There's a process that you go through for that, which includes putting, you know, a statement together or responding to some questions that you discuss with your stake president and then gets sent to the office of the first presidency. So there's a, you know, there's a committee that reviews and makes a recommendation, but a member of the first presidency, at least as I understand it, reviews each one of those applications individually and makes a determination personally about that case. And so, and this time I'll say Elder Christofferson, but my brother Todd was in a weekly meeting with the first presidency, and President Monson asked him if he would stay a few minutes later. And as after everyone left, as he did, President Monson handed him an envelope and said, you know, Todd, there's a particular thing I would like you to do yourself. And Todd opened the letter, and it was the approval for restoration of blessings for me. And so within a week, my brothers and their wives who were here in Salt Lake were in my brother Todd and his wife's living room, and Todd performed the blessing that restores the blessings of temple and priesthood. And it was amazing. I felt that the faith and perseverance and patience of my parents, who had passed away before I was returned to fellowship in the church, had been answered in the way that they had hoped. And yet the experience of it, I think, taught all of us many things that we wouldn't have known without it. And for me especially, it was a closeness to the Savior and a real understanding of his role in my life.
You know, that's an incredibly touching and powerful experience. And I really appreciate you sharing that with us, especially because I can't imagine how both you and your brother felt learning that news and being able to, how do I put it? I think one of the best things I love about Mormonism is the ability that we have to have these experiences that draw people closer together. And I've got to imagine that must have been a strengthening moment for both the bond that you and your brother had, being able to go through that together.
It's, you know, it's been an incredible journey. And I think the what paved the way for that bond to continue to grow was my parents' insight early on in the process that the mission of our family would be that we would all understand that nothing anyone could do could take them outside the circle of our family's love. And that really set the stage for how we would interact with each other for the next, you know, nearly three decades. So when those desires came that I wanted to be able to move down a path of rebaptism and restoration of blessings, you know, there were no barriers I had to overcome. I didn't have to feel embarrassed that they were right and I was wrong, or that somehow we'd been estranged and needed to rebuild a relationship. Their great love was that they could embrace the reality of my life, could accept the realities of my life throughout all those years, so that we were close all the way through. And then when there were opportunities to do these things, as you say, it brought us even closer, but it was because we've been close throughout the years before.
So speaking of your family, your story is really unique in the fact that you were immediately accepted by your family and later on by your ward. What would you say to those whose experience has been one of a loss of relationship with their families or even feeling shunned within their religious communities? Because I'm thinking in particular about those who are forced to undergo things like aversion or conversion therapy, which incidentally was even being performed at BYU. That's a tough thing. So for someone who's going through an experience where they're being shunned or having that happen, what would you say to them?
I mean, the first thing I would say is that I have been incredibly fortunate and I recognize it. You know, my parents didn't find it easy at the outset. We had a couple year or two of trying to find our footing in the new normal. Mm-hmm. They originally wondered what they had done wrong. And my father thought because he traveled too much on business, that must be why I was gay. And, you know, the next idea was, well, let's find the right therapist who can change Tom. And fortunately, a very close friend of my brother, Greg, was in a senior role with LDS Social Services in Southern California and was able to let him know that that wasn't a reasonable outcome to expect. You know, that praying the gay away hadn't worked for me, and you know, therapizing, I don't know how we'd conjugate that verb, the gay away wasn't going to work in an LDS social services setting. And so then, you know, then it became, well, let's fast. And as a family, fast and pray, and my brothers and their wives and my parents, that, you know, that somehow the Lord would intervene. And, you know, I've really come to feel that at its core, what we were asking, what I was asking the Lord and later others on my behalf was to remove the spirit from my body and put a new one in. Because I really feel like this is a, you know.
That's profound, yeah.
This is an integral part of how I approach the world and the characteristics and traits and talents that I bring. And so in that sense, you know, I don't see this as any kind of a burden. I see it as a gift in any event. But to answer your question more directly about, you know, for those who have not been as fortunate as I, you know, the only answer I can give is the one place where there is never a closed door or a cold shoulder is the Savior. And I think about the allegory of the olive trees, you know, and just 15 or 16 times over and over and over, the Savior and those who work with him try something new to be able to reach, in this case, you know, reach the heart of someone who's been wounded. And I feel that way, that the Savior is always there. He reaches us where we are and takes us where we are, and his love is always available. And so I hope and pray that those who have felt something other than love from those who should love them, their family, their ward family, will be able to feel that directly from the Savior.
So Tom, I know you can't make any predictions. I'm not asking for the spirit of prophecy here, but what do you hope the future will look like for LGBTQ members in the church?
You know, my feeling is that from conversations I have, that more and more members of the church are praying that their hearts will be prepared, that the Lord would reveal many great and important things that he is, you know, yet to reveal, that may answer some of these questions, or at least may move our understanding at least forward from where we are today. And I think that's a really critically important thing, that somehow we are united in desiring that the Lord would give us more, whatever that may be. And I think in my sense is that prophets, seers, and revelators have long been seeking to know the questions to ask, to know how we might move forward. So I don't know what the answers are going to be, but I do believe that there is possible for all of us a greater spirit of unity as we strive to be a Zion people of one heart and one mind. And I also think that when the Lord tells us that all are alike unto him, it's kind of the layers of the onion. We continue to discover more ways that we are alike unto him. And I think there's more for us to learn about that.
So Tom, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. Do you mind sticking around to chat with us for just a little bit longer?
I'd be happy to.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. You can find That We May Be One, A Gay Mormon's Perspective on Faith and Family by Tom Christofferson at Deseret Bookstores or online at Amazon.com, DeseretBook.com, or wherever you buy LDS books. And we'll be back after the break.
Apologetics can be defined as a defense of faith through argumentation. Christian apologetics comprise some of the earliest forms of Christian writings. Throughout the centuries, apologists have argued for the reality of God, legitimacy of Scripture, the creation, the fall, the preeminence of grace, and the eschatology of the end times. Adding to these, Mormon apologists have defended Joseph Smith's first vision, the embodiment of God, continuing revelation, extra-biblical scripture and temple rituals, among other topics, and have reached new levels of sophistication through training in fields such as history, philosophy, and Near Eastern languages and culture. Through multiple perspectives, the contributors to this volume explore the textures and contours of apologetics, revealing deep ideological fissures within the Mormon studies community concerning its utility. In spite of these deep-seated differences, what each author has in common is a passion for Mormonism and how it is presented and defended. This volume captures that reality and allows readers to encounter the terrain of Mormon apologetics at close range. Learn more about perspectives on Mormon theology, apologetics, by visiting gregcoford.com.
And now for your moment in history, brought to you by our friends at todayinmormonhistory.com. On September 18, 1892, First Presidency Secretary L. John Nuttall writes in his diary, quote, "I went on the 8 a.m. train to Provo, found all well. This afternoon, Mr. M. M. Warner called on me and requested permission to keep company with my daughter, Eleanor. I explained to him my reason for my objections to her doing so and to his keeping company with her with a view to marriage. I told him I wished him to not keep her company, at least until I had more proof of his intentions to settle down as a citizen and show by his acts of his honorable intentions, etc. Also that I did not want him to come to my house to visit my daughter, but to treat her as any other lady, but not anything further, which he promised to do. He then asked my permission to come to the house this evening, which I granted. This is a matter which has caused me grief and sorrow, for I cannot consent to any one of my daughters to marry an outsider. And my daughter Eleanor seems almost determined to keep Mr. Warner's company, which is very strange to myself and also her mother. I walked out with my wife Elizabeth this evening for an hour, and we talked over this matter. She is also much opposed to her feelings to Eleanor's wishes. I went to bed early, before which I went to the Lord in prayer and asked for the guidance of his spirit and asked for forgiveness for allowing Mr. Warner to even spend his evening at my house, for it is so repugnant to my feelings."
Well, now, talk about rules for dating my teenage daughter.
Nothing ever changes, Brian. People are always concerned about outsiders, fathers concerned for their daughters, and this M.M. Warner trying to slide into the DMs the proper way.
Well, hey, at least he asked. And that's our show. We'd like to thank Tom Christofferson for being our guest today. Remember to check out the Mormon News Report Extended Sessions on Patreon to hear our complete interview with him. Here's a clip.
"When I told the bishop that I wanted to be excommunicated because I was gay, he never asked me if I'd done anything.
Wow.
It simply was that I was gay, and that was good enough. A good enough reason to part ways. Right. And, you know, and I, so we've come so far in my lifetime, it boggles my mind. And yes, we've got a ways to go. There are things that we can do better, and we're learning how to do that. But I am always amazed at the increasing number of saints who really want to reach out in love and understanding and open and make a place for my LGBTQ brothers and sisters in their wards."
Just visit patreon.com and search Mormon News Report, or go to patreon.com/Mormon News Report and become a subscriber today.
We'd like to thank Scott Holmes for the music. Brian Whitney edited today's show. We'd also especially like to thank you, our listeners. If you like what we're doing, please tell your friends about us.
And if you really want to help us out, give us a review on iTunes. It only takes a few minutes and makes a huge difference.
Don't forget to fill up Brian's sack with your Q&As. If not, we're going to do more Q&As with him next week, where I ask him awkward and uncomfortable questions. Also, if you want to reach us directly, you can email us at mail@mormonnewsreport.com. Until next week, we'll talk to you again after a while.